This is Judaism Unbound, episode 124, If Not Now. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And as we start part two of this series looking at the present and future of the relationship between American Jews and Israel, we're sort of moving from the realm of mostly focusing on ideas to the realm of mostly focusing on action. It's not an exact division, but that's basically the way that we've conceptualized these two parts of the series. Today we're interviewing two members of If Not Now, a campaign to end American Jewish support for the occupation. In addition to being an organization that works on matters relating to Israel and Palestine, If Not Now is interesting in that it's not organized in the way that a typical Jewish organization might be organized, and we're going to get into that in the interview. So our guests are not necessarily in official positions at If Not Now, because more or less no one is. So today we'll be talking to Jill Rainey and Ilana Levinson. Jill Rainey is a native of Roanoke, Virginia, currently living in Washington, D.C. They are the founder and CEO of Practice Makes Progress, a D.C.-based organization that trains progressive organizers to build a more just society online and in our workplaces. She has held a variety of roles in If Not Now, including work on its We Are Jewish Enough campaign, which amplifies the voices of Jews who have been told their voices are marginal because they aren't immersed fully enough in Jewish institutional life. Our second guest, Ilana Levinson, is sort of a colleague of ours in the world of podcasting. She is the producer of a podcast called Unsettled, which provides a space for difficult conversations and diverse viewpoints around Israel-Palestine and the Jewish diaspora. Ilana has been involved with If Not Now's hashtag You Never Told Me campaign, which highlights the stories of Jews who grew up deeply immersed in Jewish institutional life, but were never taught about the realities of the occupation. Jill, Ilana, welcome to Judaism Unbound. We're looking forward to learning more about If Not Now.
Thanks for having us.
So, Jill, I thought we could get started by just a little bit of description of what If Not Now is all about for our listeners who have never even heard of the organization.
If Not Now is a movement of young North American Jews working to end our own community's support for Israel's occupation of the Palestinians. And we're a decentralized movement, which means that three or more, If Not Now, members in any part of North America, which at this point includes the United States and Canada, can decide to take an action, build a community event, hold a Shabbat dinner, really anything that builds community and works towards ending our community's support for the occupation. So that means all different kinds of stuff happening across the country and now in Canada as well are happening under the If Not Now banner. But the ultimate goal that unites all of us is that we all want to end the entire American Jewish community's support for the occupation.
And when you say decentralized, so you're talking about how any three people can put something together. What does a decentralized structure look like when compared to a more traditional centralized organizational structure?
We don't have a president. I was about to say we don't have a board, but for like administrative and fundraising reasons, we do actually have a 501c3 status and a board. But some very smart people put that board together and bylaws together in ways that make that board separate from our decision making. Our members, the people who are active, who are coming to meetings and coming to Shabbat dinners and talking to each other and planning things, those are the folks who make decisions about what campaigns we're going to run, what events we're going to hold, how we're going to talk about the issues of the moment. And that was designed really carefully so that all of the young American Jews who feel passionately about how much the occupation and mandatory support for it have harmed our community here in the United States can share their own ideas about what we should do about it. I personally have had a variety of some positive and some deeply weird experiences with Jewish institutions. I'm a longtime listener of Judaism Unbound, and it's fascinating to me how much there's a focus on, well, we can't have a Jewish community if it's not in a building with a president, with a board, in an institution, ideally with a logo. fascinatingly to me, they don't focus on the website so much. There's all kinds of generational gaps happening there. But there's this like insistence that there has to be an institution or Jews might disappear, which is not my experience at all. I grew up in Roanoke, Virginia, where there are three synagogues, but my mom's Presbyterian. I didn't really grow up in Jewish community. There just aren't that many Jews there. And lots of people grow up in places where there aren't many Jews, and we're still Jewish, even when institutional life has nothing to do with us. We're no less Jewish for that. So one of the things that I love most about, if not now, is that this idea of decentralization, that there's not a president, that there's not a staff hierarchy who's making all the key decisions, that the key decisions happen at the local level or among friends over conference calls across the country, based on what we actually want and need and think is important, and not based on fundraising decisions, which often in the mix when you have like a staff and board structure like institutions do. And it's not based on whatever life experience the people at the top happen to have. It's based on all the different life experiences of all the people who are excited about talking about it.
All right. Well, I just want to point out for our listeners that you've just in you know, the first couple of minutes of the podcast sort of really raised at least three profound and separate issues that I think could create a whole podcast conversation, which maybe we should have. We'll try to have it today, but we should probably have it in the future. There's the question of the Jewish community's approach towards Israel and the occupation. There's the question of the best kind of organizational structure for Jewish life and Jewish activity. And there's the question of how do we economically do that kind of thing in a new way, which we've talked about a lot on this podcast in terms of trying to think about what Jewish organizations might look like when they were powered by volunteers rather than by staff. So those are all fascinating. Let's take them one by one. But I thought that as a good place to start would really be to understand in a deep way, if not now's approach to Israel, partly because this is the topic of the series that we're in, and partly because it also represents I think also a set of reasons, a really particular generational approach to the substance as well as dealing with it. So let's really dive deep into that. And can you tell us a little bit about the origins of If Not Now, Ilana? Like, can you sort of give us a sense of when it started and what was going on and how did it all come about?
So If Not Now got started during Operation Protective Edge in 2014, when a bunch of young Jews came together and said Mourner's Kaddish for the victims of this conflict. And these young Jewish activists said, we cannot rally with major Jewish institutions who might want us to around like supporting this conflict. There's no way to support killing thousands of people. I saw these young Jews on Facebook. I was in Jordan at the time and feeling very confused and really lost, learning firsthand about Palestinians in Jordan, and also feeling kind of alone as a Jewish person and seeing these young Jews kind of speak out and say Mourner's Kaddish in such a deeply Jewish way made me feel like, oh, this is the community I want to be a part of. So If Not Now got started doing ritual around victims of a conflict.
Yeah, I wanted to use this as a moment, to make it clear that this is Lex, I am involved with If Not Now and have been since 2014. Just to clarify that with listeners so that it's clear that I'm sort of hosting and also straddling that line in this conversation. But I wanted to mention that the decentralized element of what we talked about before, the fact that If Not Now is sort of, it pops up in all sorts of places around the country. It's not directed by a particular set of people in one office or one city even. It was part of the DNA from the beginning, almost unintentionally. Basically, there were people mostly in New York at first who exactly as you said, recited Mourner's Kaddish, and people just followed their example. People all around the country, as far as I can tell, weren't really told, but just they saw that there was stuff happening in New York and they wanted to replicate it in their cities. And there was just momentum in these different communities all around the country, in Boston, in DC. I was actually in Jackson, Mississippi and we managed to get a few dozen people in New Orleans, which is not known for a massive Jewish community, but this was just happening organically all around the country, and sort of made it clear that there was interest in the American Jewish population, especially among millennial Jews, to create a vocal public group that was coming from a deeply Jewish place in opposition to the occupation. But following up on that, can you give us some examples? We've heard about Mourner's Kaddish, but what does sort of an if not now action look like? Obviously, it's different because it can pop up all over the place. But what are some components of what if not now's actions look like when they exist around the country and now Canada too?
So the way that I know Lex is through one of the most meaningful spiritual experiences I've had in the last couple of years. About 1,000 of us gathered outside the APEC conference last year in 2017. And because in DC, the building that hosts the APEC conference is very large with multiple entrances, we kind of split our group. And part of the group locked themselves to the doors in the front of the building and did singing and chanting and held beautiful banners. We made blue banners to part the Red Sea during that action. I was recently part of an action in DC where we blocked the doors to Senator Ben Cardin's office because Cardin has refused to criticize the IDF shooting live ammunition at peaceful protesters in Gaza. And we did this in Capitol Hill, and we sang songs in Hebrew as well as in English in the Hart Senate office building where Hebrew was echoing all through the building. If you've never been to DC, Cardin's office building is this huge glass building with like different levels. There's lots of mezzanines, lots of open space. Lo Yisagoi was echoing all throughout Capitol Hill. It was gorgeous. In DC last summer, when it first became clear, and I'm pretty sure Gazans are still suffering under this, because of the occupation, Palestinians living in Gaza have extremely limited access to both electricity and water. And the electricity crisis really came to a head last summer, and as far as I know, is continuing in a really humanitarian crisis kind of way. So we did a series of actions across the country, and in DC, we gathered outside the Hillel International Building and left stones in front of their front door because we were mourning all of the people, all the Palestinians who couldn't get adequate health care because their hospitals didn't have electricity.
And it's a Jewish tradition to leave a stone on a pebble on a gravestone.
So we were mourning Jewishly by like leaving a stack of stones in front of Hillel's building. We've done a really wide variety of Jewish ritual practices during our actions. And I mentioned earlier that Shabbat dinners are also a really important part of if not now, life, I guess you could say. We do a lot of Shabbat dinner community building events. In DC, we just had a huge 100-person Seder that lots of people who are already involved in If Not Now or curious or had heard about it but didn't really know what it was about came together for a Seder. We do a lot of singing in Hebrew and in English, occasionally in Yiddish or Ladino, occasionally in other languages. We do a lot of singing, which is one of the more meaningful parts of If Not Now for me.
I just wanted to chime in and say that I grew up in a lot of Jewish institutions for my whole life. And then when I kind of learned about the occupation, felt like during those moments of, you know, of ritual, like I couldn't be a part of those rituals with those institutions that were not talking about Palestinians. And If Not Now, and I since left, you know, those institutions intentionally and didn't have a chance to, you know, then practice the Judaism, those rituals that I love. And it's since joining If Not Now, since being able to like tune into those kinds of actions that I can like participate in my Jewish ritual again from across the country, maybe, and feel authentic about it and feel connected again.
Can we back up and I want to understand in a deep way what If Not Now's perspective is and analysis is, because essentially it's interesting to me to hear you describe the mission of If Not Now in exactly the same terms that I heard it described a few years ago, meaning it's very simple and clear and hasn't changed, which is to end the Jewish community's support for the occupation of the Palestinians. And I'm wondering if you could help our listeners understand sort of where that point of view comes from. Why is that If Not Now's mission, and why is it so simple and straightforward and clear? So, Jill, could you give us a bit of a sense of that?
I didn't go to Hebrew school. I didn't go to Jewish summer camp. So there was a lot of Jewish education that involved mandatory support for Israel that I missed out on. Real talk, I feel grateful that I missed out on that, because I missed out on a lot of toxic, racist othering of Palestinians and othering of non-Jews in general, including my own mother. When you look past how damaging that is to why our community is doing that, it's because we're terrified because of the Holocaust and because of pogroms and because of centuries and millennia of trauma against our people. And that's deep-seated and that's real. So If Not Now's strategy is to talk about ending the American Jewish community's support for the occupation. We don't take a position on the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, a nonviolent Palestinian-led movement to pressure the Israeli government to end the occupation. We also don't take a position on Zionism, the political ideology that Jews should have a homeland that is a country. And we don't take a position on statehood, one or two state solutions, no state solutions, whatever like the political borders end up being. We don't take a position as a movement on any of those things, because Jewish people are bringing all kinds of histories of really authentic trauma to exploring the reality that Palestinians are also human beings who have been traumatized by our people. How do we deal with all of those truths at the same time and end unnecessary human suffering? We focus on one thing that unites us. And If Not Now members have a whole host of additional affiliations. Some If Not Now members are very involved in boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which again is a nonviolent tactic to pressure Israel to change its policies that has been reacted to as like an existential threat by a lot of Jewish institutions and by a lot of individual American Jews. The idea of boycotting a country is scarier because of our Jewish history than it was in South Africa. But from the other side, it's just a nonviolent tactic to get folks to change their policies. But the fact that I was able to explain all of that in a couple minutes to y'all is a testament to how safe I've felt in If Not Now spaces to say, hey, I don't know what's happening here. I don't know what this context is. The occupation feels weird. I literally didn't know what the green line was in February 2016 when I joined If Not Now. I had no idea what any of this context was. I knew Israel existed. I knew they were doing shitty things to Palestinians, and that's all I got. And because I felt safe enough to ask questions and not be told that I was a fake Jew or a self-hating Jew or that I was an embarrassment to our people or I was going to get us all killed, we really go in on our people because of this deep-seated existential threat fear that we have. And If Not Now, because we focus only on this one thing, ending our community's support for the occupation, opens us up to having nuanced conversations that feel threatening to some of us and talk about why they feel threatening and give a lot of folks who either had very one-sided and harsh and often very inaccurate Jewish education or not much Jewish education for a variety of reasons, the chance to really learn about Israel and Palestine and the history of our people.
So Ilana, can we take that over to you? Because I think that, you know, rightly or wrongly, and I think wrongly, a lot of times folks will say, oh, well, somebody who only heard about the Green Line in 2016, like there's so much nuance, there's so much to learn. How could you possibly, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And what's interesting about If Not Now is it's a coalition of folks coming from all different directions. And so Jill is saying that they didn't have the education that sort of was the mandatory support for Israel education. And on the flip side, you came from a background where I think you did have that education, and you've ended up in the same place as Jill.
So yeah, I grew up going to a Solomon Schechter day school, which is a day school run by the conservative movement. I went to Camp Ramah for 10 summers, also conservative Judaism camp. I had all of the institutions under my belt, and I loved them so much. They were my community. They were everything. They were my whole world. And so I got a lot of their educational materials, I've participated in a lot of their educational programming. Now that I think about the Israel education, I don't know that I feel comfortable calling it education as much as advocacy training. Yes, they taught us facts, but selectively. And, you know, when you mentioned, I think, the Green Line, like, I didn't hear about the Green Line. I saw maps that were inclusive of Gaza and the West Bank. You know, the Green Line being the armistice line that separates those Palestinian areas. It's possible that later in life, someone taught me about the Green Line so I could refute anti-Israel sentiment. But that was why, you know, it wasn't to say like, there's a border that separates Israeli citizens from non-Israeli citizens in the country that Israeli politicians, that Israeli leaders control entirely. I had a major process of unlearning that I had to do. And I did that in college. I studied the Middle East, you know, really to be a better Israel advocate. I was told from a really young age that it's my obligation as a Jewish person to support Israel, and that being very dedicated to the Jewish community, I started a pro-Israel club in high school. And then in college, I wanted to continue that advocacy. And that was the first place that I learned about Palestinians and what they endure on a daily basis, living under occupation or living under blockade and siege in Gaza. I was a part of this group called SAFI, the Student Alliance for Israel, and they encouraged me to go on a Hasbara fellowship. And Hasbara means propaganda, basically. I think others might use it differently as PR or information or something like that. But really, for the purposes of Eish HaTorah's Hasbara fellowships, it was propaganda. It was teaching us how to refute any argument against Israel. And a couple of things happened on that trip. One is that I started to have questions from the materials that they gave me. They just couldn't answer or wouldn't. And also, they took us to Hebron or Chelil or Hebron, however you want to say it, in whichever language. The city is a microcosm of the occupation. You have boarded up storefronts, Palestinian families who have to enter the back of their home because they're not allowed to enter from the front. You have separation barriers. You can see Israelis on one side and Palestinians on the other in the middle of the street. And it was like a ghost town. And I didn't have enough information to interpret what I was feeling, but it was just this moment where I was like, I have to rethink everything that I've ever been told because I'm in this place and I feel haunted by it. And that was the moment that I started taking my college professors seriously, because when you grow up like me, a lot of times the message you'll hear is there will be professors who will tell you things because they're anti-Israel and they're anti-Semites. So I went to these classes trying to dig up dirt on my professors. I remember I got back from that Hasbara fellowship and I was like, wait a second, I'm going to take everything as though it's true, which is a ridiculous thing, you know, to think about. Like I was out to get my professors. I started actually listening to my professors. I started being much more intentional about taking classes with professors of Palestinian origin, and then studied abroad in Jordan. And that's how that happened for me.
For me, Israel is a foreign country, and that's okay. I don't have a relationship to Israel. And it's okay for some Jews to not have a relationship to Israel. When I say that, I get this immediate terror that, well, if not every Jew supports us, then Israel can't exist. And like, slow down there. I am an American Jew, and I'm going to fight anti-Semitism in the United States so I can stay here, and so my friends' children can stay here because I'm also not having kids. Clutch your pearls now. I just said a lot of things about like the Jewish community's weirdness. I almost married a non-Jew also. That's a whole story. I'm doing all these things that like institutional Jewish community says will be the destruction of our people. What I am finding is that this idea that we must support Israel at all costs, despite the horrifying harms that Israel's current policies under occupation are causing to Palestinians, it's deeply twisting our souls as Jewish people. And it's been really healing to me to be able to say in public, I am Jewish. You don't get to tell me I'm not. And I know that what Israel is doing to Palestinians is wrong. And you don't get to tell me I'm not Jewish enough to have an opinion about that. You don't get to tell me that I'm an enemy to our people because I can see that children starving in the West Bank because their parents can't get through checkpoints to their jobs is wrong. I know that's wrong. And Jewish community, Jewish values taught me that that's wrong. And I get to say that in public with other Jews where I feel safe enough to express something that our institutional community has banned for decades now.
For so long, since I first started unlearning and started learning about Palestinians, I think I thought of myself as the victim in the situation. I had this moment also volunteering in the West Bank, and then I went to Jordan for a weekend and tried to enter back into the country and was not allowed into the country for my activism. I remember my Palestinian friend picked me up because they sent me back to Jordan, and I was so mad and so how could they do this? I'm Jewish. You know, Israel's supposed to be the safe haven for all Jews. And all of a sudden, you know, I realized I'm sitting next to someone who's not allowed in the country of their family's origin. And then I get to the Israeli embassy in Jordan and see a whole bunch of Palestinian people who are trying to visit their family in the West Bank and can't. Okay, my outrage is okay. It's not okay what's happening, you know, the manipulation of Jews that's happening in our communities. But our lives aren't at stake on a daily basis. You know, we aren't prevented from seeing our sick and aging parents. And because of our ethnicity, that doesn't happen to us. That said, I think the soul of the Jewish community is at stake. What do you do when you're a people who, you know, has endured so much persecution and now you're subjecting another people to an occupation?
So I think one of the themes of If Not Now that is broadcast pretty well is this idea that Alana is amplifying in terms of folks who, like me, like Alana, grew up deeply embedded in Jewish institutions and feel like we were misled about what the occupation is or even the fact that it exists. We were led into thinking that it didn't. And I guess what I'm not sure is always broadcast just as much is the voice of people like you, Jill, and like you've spoke about so far a little bit, who don't come with all sorts of Jewish communal experiences under their belt. And so I guess I'd love to hear from you a little bit more about what's your perspective on If Not Now's work from the standpoint of somebody who has never really been at the center of American Jewish life in the way that some of us grew up with it as our bread and butter community.
I have had a variety of turning away experiences within Jewish community that have nothing to do with Israel-Palestine. And I think a lot of folks who grew up in the institutions Alana is talking about have those experiences as well. And also there are tons of American Jews who have little to no contact with institutions because they grew up in places like Roanoke, Virginia, because they couldn't afford to participate in institutions whose funding models are oriented around paying for expensive buildings. And I feel like it is a common thread united with this sense that we must support Israel at any cost in order to survive as a Jewish people. There are lots of Jews with all different kinds of experiences whose Jewishness is not less than because our lack of connection to institutions or our lack of connection to Israel. So I have been part of a group trying to start a thread, a campaign, a way of organizing within If Not Now called We Are Jewish Enough. And the first way that we use this in the DC hives are what we call chapters. We had a four-part examining Zionism series where we talked in a lot of detail. We did quite a bit of learning about the origins of Zionism, Zionism from a variety of Jewish perspectives, Zionism from Palestinian perspectives, and what this stuff that we've learned about Zionism means for our organizing, and if not now. And at the start of every one of those 2 or 2.5 hour sessions, one of the organizers read a series of statements to ground us. And one of them was, every single one of us is Jewish enough to be in this room. And I really needed to hear that. Like, honestly, I really needed to hear that. It hurts me every time I see our Facebook live streams of events and people comment, yeah, but they're not really Jewish though. Do they practice Shabbos? Do they do these other things? Like, that hurts me in large part because institutions have told me that too. Like, I was engaged to a non-Jew a couple years ago. We ended up breaking up for other reasons. But the rabbi who I finally found after a great deal of searching to marry me and my non-Jewish girlfriend, she told me that I needed to make Jewish friends in order to have a ketubah that she would be a participant to. The things that get commented on in our Facebook live streams are the same things Jewish institutions have told me, and I'm not the only one. So when we were opening up this beautiful but intense and intellectually challenging and emotionally challenging set of conversation about Zionism, we said explicitly, every single person in this room is Jewish enough to be here, and nobody's going to call you not Jewish enough.
I think this points to a question that I think we'd all need to be asking ourselves a little bit more, which is like, since when did the tribe of Judaism become more important than like the integrity of Judaism itself and what it's all about?
You know, I think it would be really important to understand more deeply what you mean by that, because my sense is that generationally this is going on, that in a way that's not really appreciated by folks who have the other position on Israel because they profoundly disagree with it, and it sort of occupies their entire experience of this. They're not really seeing a dimension which I think is, and I see as very alive in the kind of work that you do, which is that we're not talking about Jews who are not at all interested in Judaism. We're talking about people who may have come from one direction or another, but they're all sort of profoundly trying to create a Judaism that is powerful enough to make them feel like they want to stay a part of it.
For me, what Judaism was in my life has always been a guidebook for how to live and a group of people, a community to ask those questions with. And when I hear stories like that, stories about a prerequisite to signing a ketubah is get more Jewish friends, it's like, no, if you're seeing that maybe someone might not have community, even if that's an assumption, which I believe it is, like, offer ways, you know, help that person build up their Jewish community. There should be no prerequisite to wanting to live your life Jewishly.
The deep terror that a lot of people feel about all Jews everywhere must support Israel no matter what, or we'll be destroyed as a people, we'll be annihilated if we don't all lockstep support Israel, is deeply connected to the sense of, wait, this Jew has non-Jewish friends. This Jew is marrying a non-Jew. We will be annihilated as a people. I feel that those things are deeply connected. And it's been both really frustrating and really healing for me as an individual, having had a lot of othering and stressful and unpleasant experiences with Jewish institutions, to get to say in public whether I'm chained to a door or whether I'm welcoming people to a Shabbat dinner or whatever it is, to say in public that I am Jewish on my own terms, and my own terms include it is not acceptable to occupy another people.
Jill, in particular, I heard you speaking earlier with great compassion for the folks who you talked about as being traumatized by the past of Jewish history. And I guess when I think about the occupation and some of the policies of Israel that many of us find disagreeable or worse, that they come from at least part of the people who support them either believe with all sincerity that these policies, these approaches are necessary for the survival of Israel, for the existence of Israel to continue, or they also believe that, but for less rational reasons, like they believe it just as sincerely, but it comes from deep-seated trauma and they're not really thinking about it all that carefully. They don't know how to. They're not experts in geopolitics, but they're coming at it from a terrible anxiety about what might happen. And so what they're trying to do is to not take any chances. And I guess I'm wondering how an organization like If Not Now, or really just the individuals that are part of it, how they think about those folks and how they think about the right way to, let's assume that the conversation was going on. There wasn't a need anymore to do actions. The conversation was going on. You know, how would you imagine that conversation really goes in the best possible way, where one can acknowledge that there's real disagreement about this, which may come from policy disagreement, may come from trauma, but nevertheless, you know, you have a different conclusion. And how might the community be better at dealing with this? I think in many cases, a good faith disagreement about what's the right thing to do.
I would really love to be able to sit down over coffee with people who very much disagree with me on Israel-Palestine and talk about why they have this deep-seated sense that non-Jews are an inherent threat. Because I am living proof that non-Jews are not inherently threatening. We have very good reasons for being wary of non-Jews. For example, the Holocaust. But for example, like thousands of years of examples. We have very good reason to be concerned, but a political analysis I did not have 2.5 years ago that I have now is that Zionism was initially invented as a political ideology, as a movement to solve anti-Semitism. The idea was that let's get all of the Jews out of Europe, where the non-Jews, are going to try to annihilate us, and into a place where we can control and protect ourselves. I see a different way to end anti-Semitism. I share an alma mater with Richard Spencer. Richard Spencer also stole my haircut, and that was deeply rude of him. Does he know how many Jews make his haircut look better than he does? Does he know that? Me being sassy about that on the internet is one small part of how we end anti-Semitism. I believe that we can actually end this sense that among the broader world that Jews are somehow scary or threatening or to blame for things or like embarrassing or like dangerous. You want to like keep them in a different place and get rid of them from time to time. We can end that sense so that we can live peacefully alongside non-Jews, including our non-Jewish family members, which thousands and millions of us have, by the way. Non-Jews are not an inherent threat. We can join with our Jewish people who have a wide variety of different backgrounds and non-Jews to actually end anti-Semitism in all of the countries and places where Jews happen to live or where Jews might want to move. And I think a country that prioritizes people of one ethnicity over all others is just not realistic to how human beings live. Like, we like our in-groups, but sometimes we make friends in other groups, and then a couple centuries later, we're all related to each other in one way or another. That's how humans live. And I think this idea that putting all Jews in one place with big walls and guns protecting us from non-Jews is both immiserating of those non-Jews, a moral disaster for those who are helming those guns, and also just not realistic to how people live. I think we can end anti-Semitism so that Jews and non-Jews can just live wherever we want to live. Sounds pie in the sky, but I really believe in it.
Well, look, if there's one thing that Judaism Unbound does a decent job of, it's featuring pie in the sky visions about the future of Judaism. So no worries there that whether or not it's pie in the sky, I don't know if it is or not, but ending anti-Semitism is certainly a great note for us to end this episode on and for all of us to be working towards as we live our lives now and in the future. So thanks to both of you for bringing such wonderful ideas to us. Jill, Alana, it's been great having you on.
Thank you.
We're going to go ahead and close this episode out in the same way that we always do, by encouraging all of you out there to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can hit us up on Twitter at Judaism Unbound. Third, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can always hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last plug we like to make is that you can always support us with a financial donation, always, always, and you can do that with either a monthly recurring donation or a one-time gift. Either of those can take place at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening, and with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.